From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a conversation with Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who's running for president as a Democrat. Unless you're a resident of the city of South Bend, Indiana, you might not have heard the name Pete Buttigieg until April 14th.
They call me Mayor Pete. I'm a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States.
Mayor Pete has gone from being a virtually unknown second-term mayor of South Bend to being a top-tier candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination.
Hello, Pete. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
Thanks for being here. And you're surging in the polls.
There's growing momentum behind Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
The standout headline here is this. The 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, has surged.
Pete Buttigieg is the son of two Notre Dame professors. His father was an immigrant from Malta. He grew up in South Bend, then went on to Harvard, then on to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. In politics, he worked for John Kerry's campaign in 2004 and then for Obama's in 2008. He was elected mayor of South Bend in 2011 when he was still in his 20s.
Tonight is only the beginning. The sun comes up tomorrow on a different kind of campaign.
And as if that wasn't enough, Mayor Pete was deployed to Afghanistan for 7 months in 2014, during his first term as mayor of South Bend. He was then reelected in 2015 by a landslide. Perhaps not coincidentally, Mayor Pete's 2019 book is titled The Shortest Way Home.
If you were to win, you would be the youngest president in American history.
He's only 37 years old. And if he's elected, he would become the first city mayor to be elected president of the United States.
You would be the first openly gay president of the United States.
Yeah. He would also bring us the first gentleman, first man, first husband in the history of this country. Pete Buttigieg had become a sort of rock star on the Democratic field until June 16th.
Sergeant Ryan O'Neill pulled the trigger in the June 16th incident and is on administrative leave. O'Neill says 53-year-old Eric Logan approached him with a knife. That's when the officer shot and killed him. O'Neill's body camera was not activated.
Sergeant Ryan O'Neill, a white police officer, had shot a black man, Eric Logan. He died. Mayor Pete had to cancel all campaign activities and fly to South Bend to deal with the tragedy firsthand.
I will say that if anyone who is on patrol is shown to be a racist or to do something racist in a way that is substantiated, that is their last day on the street. And I would love to be able to finish my reply, if that's okay.
This tragic death highlighted a problem for Pete Buttigieg, and it's one that had remained mostly unnoticed until then: race relations and his challenged relationships with African Americans. His city has a population that is over 40% Black and Latino, but South Bend has a police force that is almost 90% white. And Mayor Pete has not been shy about admitting that he could have done better in this area. Here is his straightforward response when he was pressed about the issue of diversity in his police force at the first Democratic presidential debate.
Why has that not improved over your two terms as mayor?
Because I couldn't get it done.
Now, more than 2 months after the death of Eric Logan, Pete Buttigieg is back on the campaign trail at full speed. It's still a long shot in this crowded Democratic race, but Mayor Pete is hoping to connect with a new generation of Americans. So we invited him to our Harlem studios to find out what he's all about. Pete Buttigieg, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to tell you something. You know, when I first heard that you were running and I heard your name, I did a little bit of research. It turns out your name is of Maltese origin. It's a challenging name, and I worked hard at getting it right. Because, you know, right now we live in an environment where names like ours, long ones, challenging ones, you know, can sometimes be used in politics. Sometimes they get a negative reaction. So let's talk about that. I mean, you are who you are. It is your name. You're not going to change it. And it's pretty clear you're not John Smith.
Yeah. You know, America has this history of names being changed in order to fit in and the pressure that that creates. And I don't know what would have seemed a bigger obstacle to me doing what I'm doing if you just asked from the outside in. But having an unusual, hard-to-pronounce name might be one of them. And at the same time, it's my father's name. It's my family's name. It carries with it the story of his coming to this country. The funny thing is, where he came from, this small country of Malta,
yeah,
it's a very common name. There was actually, I wouldn't even be the first President Buttigieg in the world. There was a President Buttigieg in Malta who lived a few doors down from my family, and they're not even related.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
So this is my son's name.
Yeah.
Raúl Ariel Jesús de Todos los Santos Pérez Hinojosa.
Wow, all the saints. All right.
And my daughter is María Jurema Guadalupe de los Indios Pérez Hinojosa.
Wow.
And it's, I see you smiling and you're just like, bring it on.
Yeah.
You love it. You know, and that's kind of like the opposite of a part of what this country is feeling, which is actually they're saying, we don't want to hear those names.
Yeah.
We don't even want to see you.
Mm. I think it depends whether we experience people as people or whether we experience people as categories. One of the things that I have witnessed is people who frankly have very, sometimes very prejudiced attitudes toward a category, but are fiercely protective of somebody they know who belongs to that category, who they actually know, whether it's a gay nephew or an undocumented person who's actually in your life that you just have a totally different reaction to than what would be revealed by the way some of these folks vote. And I think what it tells us is we need to see through some of these things to who somebody is, understand their story, not just how to say their name. I'll give you an example from our own community. We had a very popular restaurant owner. He was undocumented. He was having a lot of issues trying to get his status sorted out. He used to go every year to check in with ICE and try to advance things, and he'd agreed to do these yearly check-ins. Only what happened when the new president took office was he went in for his annual check-in and he didn't come back out. People in the community were furious. And when I say the community, I don't just mean the Latino community. I mean the mostly white, very conservative area of town that his restaurant was in. All Trump voters. His own wife was a Trump voter because they really believed that this was about getting rid of bad people, but not Roberto. Everybody loves Roberto. Why would you deport Roberto? And what I learned from that is that we are so much more decent toward people we can actually picture or know or understand their stories. And this president reduces people, but it's not just this president. Right? There's an atmosphere that reduces people to categories. And while we can be sometimes very cruel to people up close too, we're generally better toward human beings we're dealing with than with categories. It's just harder to hate from up close. Now, when it comes to policy, the thing I think we need to remember is that most Americans want a comprehensive reform. And we know the basic elements of it. It's pathway to citizenship, protect dreamers, anything that is appropriate on border security is part of a compromise, more lawful immigration and getting that right. This package has come before the Congress many times, and usually one House passes it and the other one kills it.
I find it interesting. You kind of said, look, there's a package that needs to kind of occur, right? You got to do DACA, pathway to citizenship. You kind of did a list. Is that the way you see what you need to do in terms of immigration reform, kind of follow that pathway as you laid it out?
I think that's part of it. Again, maybe the greater part of it is cultural and making sure that we don't reduce people to these categories, but actually lift up individual stories and help people understand how their own community. You know, one predictor for being more open on immigration is if you just live in a place that's seen a lot of it, whether it's Iowa or whether it's a border community. The people who are most afraid of immigrants don't know any. So through a mixture of cruelty and incompetence, we have these images coming from the border now of these horrible detention conditions. But even they are useful in some ways to the administration, especially they actually know what image they're presenting. And it's an image that's designed to evoke and arouse various emotions among people. If we actually resolve that human crisis, even if it's an imperfect and temporary fix while we're dealing with the bigger picture, I think it allows us to get to a different temperature in the conversation that helps others who have resisted humane immigration policy realize that nothing is being taken from you. This is not at your expense.
All right, let's talk specifically about policy, because there are some lawmakers and lots of activists including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but not limited to her, who has said that ICE, it's not an institution that can be reformed or repaired. It actually needs to be abolished. So where do you stand on the issue?
We're going to need some kind of agency in charge of dealing with the border. But I also think there's a lot of evidence that ICE, and then we've seen what's going on with CBP, are out of control. So I think there needs to be a comprehensive review of what part of our government should accept responsibility for this work. I think a lot of things are being handled through Homeland Security or Department of Justice that are probably more matters for the Department of Health and Human Services. And it's a good time to look comprehensively at what to do. There may or may not be a future for ICE, but there will, let's be honest, have to be a future for some kind of way of handling these issues. The question is, how do we do it in a way that is humane, consistent with American values, and leads to greater security? You know, leadership has to do with taking a divisive issue and bringing it to a consensus. The consensus is actually there, at least in rough terms, among Americans, that immigration is good, that more immigration would help our country. I think about my own city. The president says America is full. South Bend's not full. We lost so many people after the factories closed that I've got enough pipes and fire stations and roads to support 30,000 more people than we have right now. And I could use 30,000 more taxpaying residents who could help.
And you can't, like, as a mayor, say to, like, Office of Refugee Resettlement, please resettle 30,000 people here? Can you say that?
We've actually had some interesting conversations about that, yeah, because there's also a very robust faith community in our city that is trying to increase the level of resettlement. It would do us a lot of good.
Let's talk a little bit about the Midwest, which we share. Tell us a little bit about what the Midwest kind of means for you. I happen to think the Midwest is extraordinarily powerful, that they can swing elections. Hello?
Absolutely.
Ohio?
Yeah.
So just talk a little bit. You know, you're growing up in Indiana. Your dad's an immigrant from Malta. He's a professor at Notre Dame. Your mom, originally from Virginia, also a professor at Notre Dame. You're in academia. What's going on for you as a little kid?
There are a lot of things about my town I didn't understand growing up. You know, I never asked why there were empty factories everywhere. It was just part of the scenery. And I had the sense that I had to get out.
And where were you thinking, like, when you were thinking, I'm getting out, was it?
I don't know. Go to the city, right? Go to the big
Chicago.
City. Chicago, New York. Well, I wound up in Cambridge. I wound up in Boston. Got to Harvard. And as soon as I got there, I began to realize, wait a minute, I'm from somewhere. I have a culture. It's a weird thing to say about being a Midwestern, but there really is a Midwest culture that you don't notice until you're in a different culture and realize how different even the way you make eye contact with a stranger is different if you're from Indiana than if you're from Boston. Now the Midwest has this kind of, some of the same people who are ignoring us, I think, now have this exotic fascination about us. You know, you feel like political reporters show up, you know, and they're like, take me to your dive bar and help me understand the key to American politics. And now it's almost overblown. But it is true that there's something very important about understanding what's happening in these parts of the country that have taken it on the chin economically, but are not bleak. There's hope and innovation and a lot more diversity than people are aware. I mean, my own city, 25% African-American, 15% Latino and growing fast. Some of the neighborhoods that almost died are coming back to life in the same patterns that fueled them 100 years ago. Only now, the large immigrant Catholic working families animating these neighborhoods and filling the churches are speaking Spanish instead of Polish.
Coming up on Latino USA, we continue our conversation with Pete Buttigieg, and we get his thoughts on race relations, whiteness, reparations, and telling the truth.
It's one of the central challenges of our time, and part of how I think this president has sort of hacked the American system. The best way I can find to combat it is to meet it with fact, to model, to show versus tell.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Earwolf Media, presenting Spanish Aquí Presents, a brand new comedy podcast highlighting the best of the best of Latinx comedy and culture. Hosted by comedians Carlos Santos, Ryza Licea, Oscar Montoya, and Tony Rodriguez. If you're asking yourself, do I need to know Spanish to enjoy this podcast? The answer is no, but you might learn a little along the way. Listen to Spanish Aquí Presents in your podcast app now and subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Bitcoin needs a huge amount of electricity to power its computers. And that has created some very unique money-making opportunities in different parts of the world. It is also causing some governments concern. Listen and subscribe to The Indicator from NPR.
Hey, we're back, and we're going to continue our conversation now with Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination.
So my son is 23. He will vote in his second presidential election. You're his favorite right now.
Well, that's good.
And so I guess my question to you is, one, what do you think about the fact that there's this young Latino college graduate from the Midwest who sees you as the candidate? Honestly, not so much because he loves everything about you, but because he believes very pragmatically that you could win.
Well, first of all, I'm excited to have his support, so tell him I said thank you. And I think it's true that, you know, even though this president is deservedly unpopular, he could very much win again if we are not smart. Now, some people think that means if we are not careful. I actually believe if we're too careful, it might be one of the worst risks we could take, because there will be a temptation to say we're going back to normal. And part of how we got where we are is that normal didn't work for a lot of people, especially in the industrial Midwest. And I think part of how the worst elements of this president's message found fertile ground is a feeling that nobody from any party was really going to do anything to change things. And so a lot of people, frankly, voted to burn the house down. Now that the house is on fire, we have to have something, I think, completely different. And that's part of what I represent. I'm not like the others.
I find it interesting that you say, I'm not like the others. You kind of are. You're a white man of privilege. And some of what I heard when you kind of came on stage and suddenly it was like, oh my God, the arrival of Mayor Pete. It was like, wow, the shining whiteness of it all.
Hmm. Well, no one wants to be reduced to any number of categories, I think. And part of what I think I need to do as somebody with a distinctive message and a different story is, to the extent that I do benefit, for example, from the advantages that go with being white or, for that matter, being male, to think about how I can enlist those advantages to make myself useful. So in the same way that, frankly, as a matter of simple math, my marriage doesn't exist unless a lot of straight people fought for it. It's also the case that because I am male, I need to be twice as robust on issues impacting women because I have the benefits of being white on my side, frankly, and I'm trying to be conscious of that. It means I need to have conversations about race with white audiences as well as audiences of color whose support I'm trying to earn.
So we're going to change now to talk about, well, it's really been a concept like many others that now we're talking about publicly. It used to be people talked about reparations for historical injustices suffered by the African-American community, kind of like reparations. And it's like, no, we're talking about reparations now. You have called for a new Marshall Plan to create economic prosperity for African-Americans. You call it the Douglas Plan after Frederick Douglass.
Yeah. So Frederick Douglass called Americans, especially in his 4th of July speech, to basically puncture our belief that we really are living up to all of our values. And going on 150 years later, we have, I think, seen the proof all around us that if you just take a racist system or a policy or a structure and you replace it with a neutral one, certainly in the case of the black experience in America, that's not enough. It doesn't lead to equality happening on its own. So the idea of the Douglas Plan is to intentionally invest across all of these areas of American life: home ownership, health, education, democracy, I mean access to the vote itself, entrepreneurship. And I think we have to do that for the next generation to succeed, but also we have to do that now in order to stop the harms of white supremacy and racial inequality from tearing the American project apart. And I think there's evidence of that happening now. This is already the force that came nearest to destroying the American experiment in the Civil War. And I think there's a risk of that happening again in my lifetime if we do not tackle these inequities in my lifetime.
So, Mayor Pete, the last time we were scheduled to speak actually was several weeks ago, and you had to cancel the interview and all of your campaign events because there was a police-involved shooting in South Bend, Indiana, where you're mayor. Eric Logan, African-American man, father of seven, was shot dead by a white police officer, Sergeant Ryan O'Neill. And I want to take a moment to talk about race relations in South Bend, because we did our research and overwhelmingly from immigrant rights organizations and activists and immigrants themselves, you get pretty much a thumbs up. But in terms of the African-American community, it's a little bit more complicated. You had a controversial plan when you were elected mayor, 1,000 homes in 1,000 days, to tear down or repair properties that were considered abandoned in neighborhoods that were most often Black and poor. And there was some criticism from the communities affected, and some said that this was like a fast track to gentrification.
I mean, look, there are political rivalries at home, just like there are nationally. And I think it's really important for people to understand that what we did with the reason we undertook work to repair and, if necessary, demolish over 1,000 houses, mainly in low-income minority neighborhoods, was because we heard the voices of minority residents saying, what is taking you so long? That you see a house crumbling for 10, 12, 15 years next door to you. Nobody can even figure out who owns it. And the longer it's there, the more you think it's there because the city doesn't care. Now, that being said, there are certainly critiques of code enforcement being too heavy-handed and a lot of other reasons why there has been a lot of challenges for us when it comes to racial tension in our city, mostly revolving around police, but much of it connected to the fact that there are neighborhoods in our city where it's almost as if the recovery never happened, and they are almost invariably Black neighborhoods and Latino neighborhoods.
So your city is 40% Latino African American. Your police department is 90% white. And you've said, I went in, I was going to make the change, I was going to diversify the police department. And then you've actually said, I couldn't do it. So I'm like, okay, well, I appreciate your authenticity, like I couldn't do it. But then there's a part of me that's like, well, wait a second, what do you mean you just couldn't do it? And if that's the case, then what is your plan to handle this, like on a national level? Or will you just be like, well, couldn't do it?
Well, I just thought I'd be honest about it. I mean, look, not everything works. I'm not staking my candidacy on the idea that every problem that greeted me on my desk, I fixed miraculously. I'm very proud of things that I really do think South Bend's growth is miraculous in many ways. But this, we just got to be blunt, this is one of the indicators that I really care about that got worse on my watch. We actually have fewer Black and Latino police officers, or at least fewer Black police officers today than we did when I came in. Not because we don't care. But at a moment when the economy is providing a lot of attractive jobs outside of policing, and there is such estrangement between many communities of color and police as a profession, there are fewer and fewer people we can find as applicants who would ever even picture themselves being in the uniform.
This notion of being honest as a politician, I mean, we're living in a time when we couldn't have imagined that it would be like this. We have a president who lies on a daily basis, is quoted in the media, even though he's lying, because, you know, journalists are trying to figure this out too. But the truth, like, how do we reclaim the truth?
It's one of the central challenges of our time. And part of how I think this president has sort of hacked the American system is that it's not built to design somebody who unapologetically tells this many lies. The best way I can find to combat it is to meet it with fact, to model, to show versus tell. What it is like to tell the truth and to face truths that are inconvenient. And I do think this comes maybe naturally to mayors because you don't get alternative facts. Like if we didn't plow the snow well somewhere, I can't thump my chest like the president and say, it's the best street ever and it's the best plowing job you've ever seen. It was spectacular. People can see it and they will take a picture and send it in and say, this isn't working. And so you live in a world where there's more of a common sense of the realities, the facts on the ground. Sometimes we have disagreements over it, but usually you're at least departing from the same set of facts. And we need to find a way to export that reality-based nature of local government into the national arena.
I want to kind of go back to what my son brought up about the fact that he said, yes, but Mayor Pete would have a first man, and that would change everything. How can you verbalize the connection between being gay, queer, and the issue of being an immigrant, undocumented Latinx?
Yeah, so I always want to tread carefully here because there's this risk of inventing equivalencies between very different experiences. But I will note two things that I think are interesting. One is that when I encounter a lot of dreamers or undocumented people, and they tell me that they're in that situation, they've gone through a decision to come out.
Exactly.
Not the same as coming out as gay.
Not the same, but coming out, yeah.
But at least there's this common experience of knowing something, realizing it creates complications, but deciding that it's important for others to know. Anyone who's been on the wrong side of some equation of belonging has a resource inside them to help others. I'm not saying it's the same for an auto worker thrown out after 18 years on a certain job who always viewed himself as an auto worker and now doesn't know who he is in addition to how he's going to earn money versus the situation of an undocumented mom on the west side of South Bend who's not sure if her family's going to be torn apart. Then again, that might be literally the same person. Mm-hmm. And there is something about this desire for belonging, secure belonging, that all of us have. And if we can deliver more of it, I think the bullying and the anxiety and the cruelty fades away.
So finally, Mayor Pete, we're asking all of the candidates that we're speaking to this question, which is, okay, here's your moment. What is your pitch specifically for the Latino-Latina voter?
So we're living in a moment of unprecedented and accelerating change. Change is happening all around us in our economy, our politics, our society, our technology. And it's triggering this fear. But the reality is we can master these changes. And the Latino community is a huge part of those changes in a wonderfully positive way. And what we need is a president who understands what these changes can mean and is determined to master them in a way that makes all of us better off. Through policy, yes, but also through language, through culture, through a process of building out that sense of belonging I was just talking about.
Mayor Pete, thank you for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
Pete Buttigieg is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. This episode was produced by Miguel Macias and Maggie Freeling, with help from Jonathan Cabral and edited by Fernanda Camarena. The Latino USA team includes Sofia Paliza Ka, Antonia Cerejido, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Jeannie Montalvo. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Jess Alvarenga. Our intern is Lucas Southard. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, be sure you stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
How's it going?
Great.
Listen to you.
Great. It's
New
going great.
Thing every day.
I'm running for president of the United States. It's going great.